Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 141 of the Distraction Pieces podcast, and I am joined this week by the legend that is Dan Hardy. I've had Dan on before. He's an absolute legend and a beast, and he's just developed so much as a commentator and an analyst of mixed martial arts. I'm making it a fight week one because we got the big UFC London card at the weekend. On Saturday at the O2, I recommend you, if you're not there live, you watch on BT Sports and all the platforms through which it will be coming into your face. So I've got a fight week this week. I've got Dan Hardy in this episode, and we speak for an hour and 45 minutes. So it's a good in-depth chat. We start the main body of the podcast is talking about his life, his career, his upbringing, his upcoming book, which is hugely exciting. And then we get into a bit of fight breaking down and things like that. So if you're not an MMA fan, don't like switch off immediately, because this is still for you. But then on Friday, I'm giving you another podcast. I sat down with Rory McDonald, who's an absolute beast of Bellator. He's headlining the upcoming London card. I only got half hour with him, but it's a hell of a half hour. You're going to enjoy it. Before we get into all that, we're brought to you by Speech Development Records. As ever, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Head there and buy some merch. Support the podcast. I feel like I say this and you zone out and move on and ignore it. That's fine. I understand that. As you're listening to this, I'm in LA at the moment, so I've pre-recorded these episodes. No, in fact, as you're listening to this one, I've just got back from LA, so ignore that. Hopefully in LA I've recorded some good guests, but we shall see. I'm there to hustle. Oh, before we get into the podcast, my club night, We Are Lizards, returns to the book club on March 25th, and I want to see as many of you down there as possible. It was amazing at the last one. It's the most people I've had down that we're talking about the podcast and have heard about it on the podcast. I've been doing the club night for 4 years, and I'm there from doors till closing, kind of just hanging out with everyone, having a laugh. I do my DJ set under a rubber lizard mask, so I sweat and play banging tunes for an hour. But other than that, I'm about and chatting to you lovely, lovely people. So come down on March 25th, the book club in London. Doors are at 8 p.m. It's free before 9 p.m. So come on down. You can get on the queue jump list. If you follow me on Instagram, you'll see that by about 10, 11-ish, we normally have queues around the block. You can get on the queue jump list by sending your name to info@thetrashsociety.com. That's info@thetrashsociety.com. I will have posted about it online as well. So check that out. Come hang out with me, Eddie Temple Morris, Cutmaster Swift, DJ Destruction, Discotheque Credits, Redshift Rebels, a.k.a. Chris, a.k.a. Craig, Disco Stew, a.k.a. Stew, off the Drunk Cast and off of Hardcore Listing. So, yeah, come and check us out. I want to mention that Dan Hardy, we do discuss it in here, but he's got a book coming out, and it comes out on Thursday the 23rd of March, and I've had my book out. You all supported me so hugely with the Distraction Pieces book. And pre-orders are really important. So if you can head over to Amazon and pre-order Dan's upcoming book, that would be fantastic. If you want to get it signed, on March 22nd, he's at the Waterstones in Nottingham at 6:30. On March 23rd, he's at Manchester Arndale Centre at 5:30. March 24th, Waterstones Leadenhall, London at 12:30. Thursday the 30th of March, he's in Waterstones, Birmingham at 5:30. Friday the 31st of March, he's at Easons Dublin at 12:30. Then Tuesday the 4th of April, he's at Waterstones in Edinburgh at 12:30, and then at Waterstones in Glasgow at 6 p.m. So go and support the man and hook that goodness up. He's a wonderful dude. I'll let this go straight in. This is episode 141 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Dan Hardy. Right, I'm here once again. This is the first ever in-person repeat guest I've had on the podcast. I'm joined by Dan Hardy. How are you doing?
I'm really good, mate. It's good to be here.
It's been a while, isn't it? It has. It felt warranted. I've had B. Dolan on a few times, but that's always over Skype, and it's normally because he's got some governmental party he's trying to take down, and I'm like, yeah, we should do a podcast about this.
Who are we taking down today, Pip?
Yeah, exactly. But how are you?
I'm good. I'm really busy, which is exactly how I like to be.
I was going to say, it's one of the reasons is instantly, as soon as the option of doing this came up, you've been so busy since the last podcast anyway. We've got tons to talk about. I need to put a little prerequisite at the start that we talk loads in real life, so I can't remember what we talked about on the podcast and what we've talked about him. So if we repeat anything, I apologize to any listeners now. If we go over any old ground, it's how can you remember which conversations were us in the Fighting Talk studio at UFC and which were
over text message at 4 o'clock in the morning when the pay-per-views are on.
exactly. It's a hard one, but you've been insanely busy as since then, going from strength to strength, presenting wise, and with all of the breakdown shows are going down an absolute treat. I think you and John have kind of secured it as you two.
Robin Black
is fantastic, and Jack Slack are my that's my three go tos to have fake knowledge when I watch the fights live. So how's all that been?
It's been awesome. It's been really cool. I mean, it's been strange because when I was offered the job with the UFC, it wasn't to be an analyst.
Yeah.
And the two roles in commentary is obviously the play-by-play role, which was Goldie and now John Annett, and John Gooden as well. And then there's the colour role, which is the whoever sits by them. So Rogan or one of the fighters.
Sort
of
Stan.
Yeah, DC.
Cruz,
or,
yeah, DC, yeah.
You know, so they've got a few options there. Now that's become more of an analyst role.
Yeah.
And they're using the other guys on Fox and this and that. So when we started doing the Inside the Octagon over here, I wasn't really sure where it was going to go. And I'd never really worked as an analyst before. I was just analysing fights like I would for my own, you know, for like when I was researching an opponent to fight.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was all very organic. And it was actually quite nice to just remove myself from it entirely and watch two fighters that I'm a huge fan of and, you know, deconstruct both of them.
Yeah, completely. Did you find a heightened level of honesty in breaking down opponents when they're not your actual opponent? Because there's got to be something in you that when you're breaking down an opponent that you, in your head, you shit on him a little bit. Or like, that, he's not as good as this or not as good. Whereas now you can go, just look at all the positives and negatives and not have that fear of, do I have to accept he's better at me than wrestling or better at me than this and that?
It is nice to be completely removed from it and to look at it more honestly as well. And the other thing, which, I mean, a lot of people don't know I do this when I'm preparing, but I'll study a fighter. I'll watch their whole back catalogue of fights, everything I can get a hold of. I'll make all my notes. I'll have an idea of what I think they're going to try and achieve in the fight, how they're going to try and achieve it. And then I'll do a training session where I will mimic the fighters.
Oh, wicked.
Which is funny because we've just been having a conversation off set, which is... very, very similar to that. It's almost like being a method actor. You kind of kind of take on skills of fighters, which I never did because it was always me against them. So I would watch them and I would see them and I would maybe, you know, try and pick up a couple of techniques just to understand how they would use them against me.
Yeah.
But now I'm actually integrating things into my own skill set from just studying. I mean, we've just done the Khabib against Tony Ferguson breakdown, and I mean, I learned so much off both of those guys because they're both very different fighters to my style.
It's frustrating because we're recording this just before that card. It's going out just after that card, but what a card.
And unbelievable.
Khabib Ferguson, I think, is the people's headliner, right? That's such a matchup.
Yeah, I mean, that's the feedback from the because we've done the breakdown show for the main event as well as the co-main event, but already the viewing figures for the co-main event breakdown are far higher.
Yeah.
Which I always find interesting because I like a rematch, and I mean,
yeah, completely.
I wasn't massively thrilled with the first fight with Woodley and Thompson.
No.
I thought it was intriguing, but from a fan's perspective, it didn't get me fired up like a Diego Sanchez Clay Guida kind of fight. But it was fascinating in how the two styles, you know, worked against each other.
And it's a fascinating one for a rematch because you've got someone like Thompson, who, again, we were kind of discussing this off mic earlier, is he's got a lot of fight intelligence. He's a very intelligent and calm, intelligent guy. So you feel those guys, once they've had five rounds with someone, could potentially learn more and figure them out. But you know, a Woodley is with one of the best camps in the world, and I'm not saying he's not got the same fight intelligence, but I think he is more of a passion fighter, an explosive, go at it, cunning. So it makes it an interesting rematch. But the build up to Tony and Nurmagomedov couldn't have gone better for preparing for it. The fact that Nurmagomedov in his last fight looked absolutely devastating, but also got caught. So it suddenly opens a question you'd never had before, and you had Ferguson demolishing the former champ and one of the best at that weight class. So it's a perfect storm.
Yeah, it's that shot that Michael Johnson landed was the question that we needed to give this fight a more balanced feel.
100%,
because Khabib's unbeaten,
and
he's coming in against Tony Ferguson, who's got losses on his record. Yeah. You know, and a loss to Michael Johnson, who had obviously just lost to Khabib. Yeah. So, I mean, common opponents are always interesting, but MMA math never really works out, does it?
I think
I've got a win over Fedor if you follow my record. You know what I mean? It's like one of them. You know, I beat...
Technically.
Akihiro Gono, that's my doorway to all of my...
He
beat loads of good people, so...
There's people like Gono or Krokop or someone like that are basically the Kevin Bacon of the MMA world. You can get to almost any fight. A Nogueira will get you to almost any fighter if you've got that win or that fight. But I mean, it's also that fight, I think, couldn't have gone better for Khabib, because it sets up a potential fight with Conor all the more excitingly because of that getting caught and everyone knowing the weight of Conor's hands. And the hype around at this event has kind of highlighted how big Khabib is. And I saw an article headline on the way here. I didn't get a chance to read it, but it said, is Khabib bigger than Conor McGregor, or actually bigger than Conor McGregor? And obviously they're not meaning, because Conor is the biggest MMA star of all time. But you look on, just pick an example. I'm sure we both follow Joe Rogan on Instagram. If he posts anything, there's a million comments from a Russian saying Khabib time, or Dana, or Dana as well. Just anything, there'll be a post about absolutely anything, there'll be hundreds of comments, Khabib time, Khabib time.
And even I use that in the gym. As soon as I get the legs bound and try triangle both the legs together up against the fence, that's Khabib time.
It's perfect. But it's kind of that. It's weird how there's an element, and Ronda and Tyson were examples of this, I guess, where if you look too undefeatable, it starts to lose a bit of its appeal. I remember that with Tyson, where I'd stay up for his fights, and then you get to the point where it's like, it's over in 20 seconds. Yeah. It's like, is it worth me staying up all this time? So that slight frowsy of Khabib, I think, was...
People want superheroes, but they also want the superheroes to be just a little bit vulnerable.
Yeah.
No one would like Superman if it wasn't for Kryptonite. That's my theory.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because there needs to be a way for them to fail in order for them to win every time.
And again, it's that... I think an example is the universal hate of... or not universal, but the quite widespread hate of John Jones at points is because he's always just looked that good, and that makes it hard to relate. And Anderson had similar hate when he had a few fights that were boring and he just looked too cocky. And then Chael beat him up for five rounds, but he got through that. And I think that reinvigorated Anderson and kind of made people go, wow, what a champion, rather than this guy's just better than everyone and he's not even trying that hard anymore. He's just going, that easy. Makes it relatable and grounds it a bit, I guess. It does.
People like me far more after I've been beaten up four times in the UFC. Especially after Anthony Johnson beat me up. I think there was a lot of pity there. There's a lot of people feeling sorry for me.
That was it still blows my mind that Rumble was ever a welterweight, a middleweight. Anyway,
he'd have to lose a leg now to make 170. Probably a leg and an arm. I mean, he's such a massive human being.
Yeah,
even at 170 he was, but
he's a big old lad. So how's everything going, kind of health wise? Just to say, we are going to
a breakdown UFC London a little bit as well at the end. But I like to leave that till the end. So people who aren't MMA fans can just... It's a conversation.
Yeah.
A thing that's intrigued me hugely is your ever-evolving rig at your place. How's that all coming along?
It's amazing. It's hit a whole new level this last weekend.
Every time I think I'm seeing a post that it's finished, a month later I see a new one that's... now we're building this and this and this.
Well, the reason that that happens is, and a lot of, nobody knows this, but the person that built the rig for me is my original martial arts instructor.
Oh, wow.
The person that I started training with when I was six, his name is Mick Rowley. And if anybody reads my book, they'll read all about him, because he was a very, very influential person in my life.
Yeah.
You know, a very good martial artist in his own right, a great fighter, but a great coach and a good friend. And it just so happens that he's an awesome metal worker as well.
Wow.
So I went to him and I explained what I wanted, and the guys that he worked with were laughing at him, because we built the rig. He came to my place, he measured the room up, and we built the rig and designed it, and it was set up in his workshop. And then every day he'd come into work and he'd think, oh, I can add that to it, and he'd build up a new piece. And
what a find to have someone whose mind is in both of those worlds.
Right?
I at the end of last year, I had a salmon ladder built in my back garden, and explaining what I wanted and what it was to a metal worker, it took me ages. They were just like, what's it? There was no understanding of it. It's great now, and it's there, and it works, and it's sturdy. But to have someone who's building the rig, but also comes from a martial arts and training background, at least.
Yeah, and somebody who is...
I mean, we should explain what a rig is. It's going to be your big cage or unit to do a multitude of exercises in for full body functional workouts, I guess.
I mean, I got the idea from CrossFit, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that's really pioneered the rig, the CrossFit rig. But that's just a basic, you know, rectangular framework.
Yeah.
There's nothing particularly complicated about it. Now, you can go to different gyms and you'll see they've added a punch bag onto it, or, you know, whatever. Now, the room that is the gym in my house is an awkward shape, and it's got a slightly sloped ceiling on one side.
Right.
And because it's an old building, it's 120 years old, all the floor's crooked and the walls are leaning weird, so it had to be specially made for my house.
Yeah.
And because the space is quite limited, I've always wanted a space where I've got everything I need.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was convinced that the space I had was adequate enough, even if it was a weird shape. So I went to Mick and we sat down and I told him all the things that I wanted, and I'd drawn loads of stuff up, because I was fortunate enough to have done graphic design at college, so I was able to... I can do three-dimensional drawings.
Oh, wicked.
Well, that and part of...
Mate, at some point I'll show you the shit drawing I sent to the person who was building my salmon ladder. I was like, kind of, if we had this, and that would be good. Yeah, that's good, that's handy. Yeah.
Well, you know, and I've built enough Lego sets to be able to see things three-dimensionally. Yeah. So I drew up a basic rig, and then, you know, he's added things to it, and we've adapted things. And the amount of times I'd send him something, I'd say, okay, this, I'm thinking of adding this to it, and change it. He'd say, well, we need to attach a Wing Chun dummy to it, or we need to put pulleys on there. I always thought that he'd be the person to do it, because, I mean, Bruce Lee had a guy that would make all of his tools for him.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of a better person. And also because he's, you know, he's in good enough shape, and you know he's still young and strong enough to be able to come over and train with me as well. So I want to be able to get some of that old school traditional martial arts back into my training.
I love that, and I think CrossFit gets a hard rub at times, because I started doing it begin the last year, and it's been absolutely a life change, and it's got me in better shape than I've ever been in. One of the routines I've been sent several times is one of yours,
right?
So it's weird. It'll say, today as your warm up, here's a video that from Dan Hardy's website. Like, all right, I'll work out with Dan for the morning, so that's nice. But because there's this view of it being post a picture every time you work out, and it's all competitive and all in the gym together and all being over the top, but it doesn't have to be. Like I said, I've been doing it for a year and a bit. I think I've posted about it twice online, but I've loved it. I think the fact that it's full body and functional, that surely translates brilliantly for a mixed martial arts, because it's not just, oh, we're building up a bicep, which, what you're going to do with that bicep? Are you going to, you know, it's a weird one. So has that been a new, a lease of life to your fitness and training, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, I was using a CrossFit gym in Las Vegas before I left, mainly because my wife was using a rigging point. They had aerial rigging points, so she was in there training, and I would go and work out. And I found this because it was a big open space that you could just throw things around in and sweat and get grimy and throw chalk all over the place. You know, it wasn't one of those nice, polished, clean, you know, I'm not pointing fingers, but a Virgin Active kind of place, you know what I mean?
No, I know what you mean completely.
Everybody's there wearing, like, you know, headbands and Ed Hardy t-shirts, and, you know, they've spent 3 hours doing their hair and makeup before they got to the gym.
Yeah.
Like, that's not my kind of place. So I wanted something that was just basic and solid and immovable. And I've always wanted to be able to tie a bunch of bags up at the house, and it's got everything, basically. It's got everything that I need. Yeah. Now, the only thing that we're talking about adding on is to somehow put a cage wall in there.
Brilliant.
But we'll figure that out. But we're actually looking at offering these to other people as well. We're actually looking at you know, turning it into a business.
Yeah. It's a great idea, the bespoke element of it, and having that expertise. I feel I have to give a shout out. And if you're ever in the Northeast, but the guy who sends me my exercise every day is Sam Marshall at CrossFit Chesterley Street. And again, it's exactly that. They got a big empty room, and I made it hard and ugly and rough and aggressive, but
it's an amazing thing. It's a workspace, right? It's a workspace.
Yeah, that's exactly. It occurred to me I had to give that shout out because, as you were saying that, I remembered when I first met Sam Marshall and we were playing Xbox Online, his gamer tag was The Outlaw.
Nice.
So he's a fan. It just suddenly occurred to me that I'm talking about his gym with you, and I've not given it a shout. So, it's great. But so, what's your kind of plan health wise then? Because you're posting a lot. Of your training, and you're looking sharp. Your footwork's looking good. And again, I guess if you're doing all these breakdowns, and you're saying you're learning a lot. Mm. But the last time we spoke, there was a hope to come back at some point. Is that still the desire and the goal?
Yeah, I would. I mean, there's definitely still a drive to fight. I would definitely like, you know, a couple more. I've always said, everybody that asks me, I always say the same thing. I'm not interested in the belts and the rankings and stuff. I don't want to get in and start fighting contenders that are on the rise, that are looking at, you know, still becoming champion.
Yeah.
I'm looking at, you know, a couple of fights against veterans that know their game, know the sport, and are, you know, smart, wily guys that are, you know, established in their MMA careers. Yeah. And there are a lot of fun fights out there of guys that would really challenge me. And because I'm in this role where it's my job to study and to pull these fights apart. And the other thing as well is that I used to watch very select fights when I was fighting. I would pick out guys that I wanted to watch and emulate and try and, you know, learn from. And the other guys on the rest of the card that I felt were making too many mistakes, I would ignore it because I felt like it was making me worse. Now, because I watch it all, I can see the patterns throughout the sport. So when when I'm in the gym, I'm able to flow far easier from one thing to another without really having to think about it.
Yeah.
And I'm far more connected to my reptilian brain, which was something that I started to understand in my last two fights, really.
Yeah.
Dwayne Ludwig and Amir Sadala, I started to understand it, and I mean, in the Ludwig fight, that's what got the knockout, because I was living in that space. Yeah. But there's a real disconnect from the physical and the mental in mixed martial arts, and I feel like bringing forward the mental and being able to connect with that space is what's going to not only move my martial arts forward, but move the sport forward generally. I mean, we're seeing lots of psychologists getting involved now. And, you know,
I think Dominic Cruz is a great example of that, of his fluidity and ability to just change. And it was really interesting in one of Robin Black's breakdowns when he was doing TJV Cruz. He was saying, as great as TJ is, he's learnt drills and he can move from that drill to that drill.
Yep.
Cruz, it's just a natural, a fluid thing. He's not moving from this drill to this drill. He's just throwing what comes naturally, and that's the advantage he saw. But I mean, it's exciting, the thought of you coming back for some big fights, some fun fights. You could be a great excuse for Bisping to dodge a Jacare and Romero a little longer after he's done with GSP, if he wants that reason. But we were texting about it, and we kept it light. But what did you think of young Michael Gall? Because it cracked me up. I said to you, I think he's a very clever a young kid at picking fights he can't lose, in that if he loses to Dan Hardy, former title contender, he's had three fights or four fights. It's no big thing. If he loses to Sage Northcutt, which everyone wants to believe is the ultimate fighting machine,
yeah,
it's no big loss. If he lost to CM Punk, I mean, that was the one, I guess, that would have been a big loss, because you've lost to someone who's got no experience. But
yeah,
after that, I think it's clever. But did that kind of did that make you laugh? Did it piss you off? Did it?
No.
What was your reaction?
It didn't piss me off at all. It took me completely by surprise. I mean, as you know, we always stay up and watch the pay-per-views, yeah, when we can, and I was sat watching it live, and
yeah,
immediately Twitter broke, and everyone's you know, asking me if I'm going to fight him. And
of course it did.
You know, I love his enthusiasm, and I do love the fact that he's calling what he wants, because yeah, there aren't enough people doing that. You know, that we need people that are more certain of themselves, and it's yeah, surprising that he is, being what, four fights into his career,
yeah,
you know, I mean, really the sky's the limit for him.
Yeah, just having that forward thinkingness of saying, well, the fact is, you spent all this time training, and then you get this short moment on the stage, and then you're off again because there's another fight and there's a bigger fight, and you're not headlining. So it's that idea of making them go away with something that makes them remember you and talk about you, and
yeah,
give you somewhere to go after that.
Yeah, and he's naturally a very charismatic kid. And, I mean, let's be honest, if he manages to get the world title at some point in the future, it would be a movie. I yeah, mean, you know, going from, you know, looking for a fight,
yeah,
calling out CM Punk, to getting that fight and the confusion around that matchup, so having to fight somebody else. I mean, yeah, it's, you know, it's fascinating. It's
100% true, yeah.
I'm looking forward to watching him develop. I mean, from my personal perspective, that's just not a fight that would interest me at all. No. You know, he's a kid in the sport, and I am a veteran, and yeah, you know, I'm an old man, I've got grey hair in my beard, and, yeah, you know, yeah, like I've had what, well, 40 odd fights, you know,
yeah,
I need someone that's more established in their game, and there are a yeah, lot of guys out there that are, you know, they look sharp, and they're having great fights, and they're still evolving later on in their career, and a lot of fun challenges. I mean, you know,
it's funny, because on paper it's actually a hard one for a commission to sanction.
Well, yeah,
just because of a win loss record, and yeah, again, he's built enough of a name so it would work. But as genuinely as someone that gets taken into account and looked at to see if it's a level playing field and all that, and
yeah,
yeah,
I mean, yeah, you know, he's a kid that's going to develop and he's going to do big things. There's no doubt about it. He's got the skills already. You know, he's still green. He's still learning a lot. There's still a lot of holes in his game, and I'm looking forward to watching that development, especially because he's found the world stage at such an early stage in his career.
Yeah.
It's very rare that we get somebody so early on in their MMA career in the UFC. I mean, I can't think of many guys that have had less than sort of, you know, 8, 9, 10 fights. Even yeah, the guys that are signed with 8 fights are usually unbeaten. So,
unless they've come through tough, yeah. Again, yeah, it's literally you have that built up experience and record to
even tough has a 3-fight minimum now, I believe. So, yeah, you know, it's going to be a fun prospect to watch develop.
Yeah,
but for me, I would struggle to motivate myself for that. You know, especially because I only see myself having, you know, maybe 2 or 3 fights.
Yeah,
you know, my contract has 3 fights on it, and I think that's realistic. I'm 35 this year, and I don't want to be fighting 3 times a year again.
Yeah.
My main role is now with the UFC as a commentator and analyst.
Yeah,
because really, if I'm honest with myself, I feel like I serve the sport much better in that role.
Completely. When we were doing Fighting Talk on BT, there was a few times I kind of half mentioned it to you. Then that the first time I heard you saying that you wanted to get back in, I was kind of like, man, like, I'm a massive fan of watching you fight, but I think you're smashing it. You've gone on to have a career afterwards, and that's yeah, not always an easy thing for fighters. It's a dangerous area. So it was kind of that feel. But then I said, hearing you, or number one, seeing you seeming to be in the best shape of your career, and hearing how you feel, again, fight intelligence and mentality wise, you've developed hugely over these years. That
yeah,
it's an
yeah,
interesting one.
My boxing coach said it to me when I first got sidelined. His name's Jimmy Gifford, and he's yeah, absolute legend. Yeah. He's Lorenzo's boxing coach as right, well. He's yeah, you know, he's a very good guy. South Boston. He's, you know,
great,
loads of character.
Yeah.
He said to me, in a year's time, you'll see the sport completely differently. Because he came from boxing. He was specifically a corner man. He started cornering pros at 13. So, you know, he's been in around professional combat sports for a long time. And when he made the crossover to mixed martial arts, he was basically brought out to Vegas and sat in a room with, well, it would have been UFC to sort of 1 to sort of, I don't know, 110 about around then. And he just sat and watched every one of them back to back and watched the sport evolve. Oh, wow. And he's absorbed it like a sponge, and he's taken his boxing knowledge. And
that's amazing.
And he said the same thing to me. He said, when you watch that volume of fights, I mean, I probably watch 4 hours of fights a day.
Mm.
You know, even when I'm in the gym, I've got, you know, I'm in the reptile house. I've got my laptop set up on the windowsill, and I'm just absorbing all the time, whether it's Glory or EBI or, you know, Polaris or some obscure MMA show that, you know, that I find online. I watch it all. I want to see it all because the sport is evolving so quickly. I feel like I don't want to miss a beat. You know, I want to see everything.
It's what's amazing about Fight Pass is there is that accessibility to that amount of fights now. It's my theory on why The Ultimate Fighter has started to struggle slightly, because I remember in the early days of that, it was exciting to get an MMA show every week.
Yeah.
Whereas now you've got access to so much, it's hard to make that reality MMA show appeal as much as potentially, again, if you look on Fight Pass, you've got a Glory event at the weekend or EBI or whatever else. Yeah. So,
yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I always enjoyed The Ultimate Fighter, but it started to get frustrating when it started to play more towards the reality TV aspect and less towards the martial arts. Like I always wanted to see athletes preparing for combat instead of kids preparing for fights.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And that's kind of how it felt. And you know, especially when The Ultimate Fighter house kind of became a bit of a free-for-all.
Yeah.
And, I mean, alcohol, I don't mind people celebrating a win and having a drink and, you know, whatever. But when it was such a big part of the show, it put mixed martial arts in a bad light, and I started to gravitate away from it and then just focus on the actual fights themselves.
Yeah, completely. But because it is weird, because again, particularly, or from the start, because of the prevalence of BJJ in mixed martial arts, and BJJ, again, it's a thinking man's game. It would mean that the fighters that got to an elite level, your GSPs or any of these, are intelligent, calm guys kind of thing. It's not your meatheads anymore, and occasionally the Ultimate Fighter would paint a different picture, because it would be that kind of, oh, and again, I guess it's a tactic. I thought Mitrione was fantastic when he played the role of kind of a crazy weirdo or an annoying guy. And then at the end, he kind of said, no, I got in everyone's head.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to pick me as their fight, which means they're fighting me because they hate me and they're going to fight angry.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go in there and pick them apart and stuff like that.
They're the interesting storylines. Yeah. They're the storylines where you do get to see the bigger picture of the sport, and you know, the reason that Conor McGregor is so popular is because of the psychological warfare and all the extracurricular activities that are around it, which a lot of the time we miss. And this is why UFC Embedded is so popular, because it's a little window inside that fighter's world. And I mean, that was what I was more interested in when I was coming up than anything else, because as a developing fighter, I wanted to see if I was doing the right things. Especially in a sport that nobody had the answers to. I mean, you know, we were going to a boxing gym and hitting speedballs and jumping rope and, you know, doing bar bag, you know, jumping over a bar and hitting a bag as a circuit. When in actuality, it wasn't really preparing us for mixed martial arts, but we just didn't know.
So.
And I mean, YouTube wasn't really available back then. Yeah. So, you know, when the internet really kind of connected the world of mixed martial arts, that opened up a lot of doors and a lot of eyes.
And so many of the gyms would have just been piecing together the bits of knowledge they've got and the bits of stuff they've got. Yeah. So it would just be a bit of a mismatch. When this goes out on the Wednesday, on the Friday, I've got Rory McDonald on, and I spoke to him earlier in the week, and he was an example of that, of the first generation of people who came through trained as a mixed martial artist, like purely kind of not coming from one discipline and not at a gym that's claiming it's doing UFC, but it's a boxing gym that's bringing in a bit of wrestling or vice versa. So, yeah, it's kind of exciting now that all of that can come together.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of laughable looking back. And obviously, he's fighting Paul, who came up with me. I mean, we were...
Yeah, of course.
We sparred hundreds of thousands of rounds. I have videos of our old training sessions, which were just mats in a sports hall with the two of us.
Oh, wow.
Shin guards and gloves, and we'd spar 40 rounds.
Amazing.
I'm not joking, 40 rounds. That's insane. We would just be there hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I know where Paul's come from. I know what he sacrificed to get to where he is, but he's still very much old school.
Yeah.
You know, he was ninjutsu to mixed martial arts, you know, and everything's decompartmentalized in his game. And he's done a good job of, you know, amalgamating them over the years. But you look at Rory McDonald, who effectively started with the sport of mixed martial arts, which is kind of scary. And I've trained with Rory as well. I was up in TriStar when I think he was preparing for BJ Penn.
Right.
And I mean, I've still got a scar on my elbow. He's a monster. He's an absolute beast. I mean, I've still got a scar on my elbow where he smashed me into the cage. He's a strong individual that has no seams in his game.
I always love hearing anyone of our kind of age or era that started off training in ninjutsu, because you know it came from a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. It made you go, I want to be Leonardo, or I want to be Donatello. So I love the fact that will have been the in route to going, I want to be a martial artist like those turtles and that rat.
if I'm not wrong, and I've not spoken to Paul in a couple of years, but if I remember right, it was a combination of ninjutsu and ice hockey that got him to mixed martial arts.
Brilliant.
And I remember, and he was the only person I ever saw stop somebody with low kicks in an amateur fight.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. First time I ever saw it. I was in a sports hall on mats, the KSBO tournament.
We are going to talk about your book that's coming out. And I've been sent a preview and only been able to skim a few bits. And it's amazing. It's a hell of a story. But... It just made me think there. Can we talk a little bit about your starting off in martial arts at 10 years old in quite rough, tough, unpleasant gyms or challenging gyms, I guess,
is
the situation.
Yeah, there were a lot of challenges. I've actually relived a lot of that old stuff of this past weekend as we've been installing my new rig in the gym, because Mick's been over and we've been going, oh, you remember that guy, you remember that story. And
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate to have found that school because, I mean, it was Taekwondo school. We had the Taekwondo suits and everything, but we were grappling and we were hitting hook and jab pads, you know, focus mitts. And, and this was all because my old instructor was just obsessive about martial arts. You know, he introduced me to Bruce Lee was obviously the main one, but all of those martial arts stars from Jackie Chan to Van Damme to Cynthia Rothrock and, you know, everybody in between, Gordon Lau, just all of it, all the Golden Harvest movies, and that he was really the rooter. I mean, I started with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, as you said, as a lot of kids did from our generation, but that's what got me into the dojang.
Yeah.
What kept me there was mixed enthusiasm. And kept me there for, 17 years I trained with him.
Yeah, that's insane.
I got my black belt under him. And, you know, I still have so much to be thankful for. But then I look back at how challenging those days were and see why. I mean, at times, it was just literally me, him and my granddad at training.
Yeah.
And nobody else had come because they were hard sessions.
Your granddad comes up a lot in the book as a massive influence. Derek, if I remember correctly, as a massive influence on your career and driving you into that. So was it him that kind of took you down there for the first time and said, look, go and stop punching people in the street or whatever else it may be? And were you a bit of a tearaway as a youngster?
You know, I was a very quiet kid.
Yeah.
As my friend Paul Gibson, who helped me write the book, very insular. I was very quiet. I spent a lot of time on my own playing with Lego and reading about pirates.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't really until I was at school that I was really interacting with kids. I wasn't interested. But then when I realised that other kids liked the Ninja Turtles as well, and we had that common ground, we were playing Ninja Turtle. I was amazing. Running around fighting and stuff. So. I had a lot of energy, but there was no like malicious intent. Yeah. I wasn't an angry kid, really. I was just very quiet. But because I was so enthusiastic about it, and because I was, you know, basically running around kicking stuff in class at school, you know, my parents decided to take me to Taekwondo, and I had a couple of friends nearby who were training already, and I went along to their school. And it was, I mean, it wasn't pleasant. I didn't enjoy it for several years.
Yeah.
I got knocked out in my first tournament. That was very unpleasant. Yeah. And
how old were you, or roughly then, when you got knocked out for the first time?
I think I was 8.
Man.
7 or 8. I started when I was 6. Yeah, I started when I was 6, and I double graded within a year to yellow belt, and then I had my first tournament. And yeah, I was about probably 8. I was no older than 8, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And then the other thing as well is, you know, the school was divided into 2, so it was Mick Rowley who was one instructor, and then there was another instructor as well his name's Paul. And he was a bully. I mean, he was just an unpleasant person to be trained by.
It can be a weird world, because there can be a belief that being a bully in that situation is what's good for them. That's training. And again, I think that's developed a lot. I don't think you have too much of that now. But there is certainly a mentality in certain gyms and in certain places where it is, well, I came up the hard way. We've got a toughen them up, which isn't necessarily the way, because I guess it's at a time where there's a difference between a mixed martial arts athlete and just somebody who wants to be hard and can beat people up. That's not the same thing. It's what I love about the sport is 90% of the time they will shake hands afterwards, or, I mean, as you've done, go and train with people you've lost with afterwards, or have people you've beaten train with you and things like that. That it's not that kind of, I fucked that guy out. Do you know what I mean? It's a contest of arts, which obviously, isn't the case when you've got a big guy teaching kids and being a bully.
Well, the thing was, I mean, really, in hindsight, it's the absence of mixed martial arts created a window for these people to step into martial arts and become bullies, you know? Yeah. I mean, and you're right, there were some people that were, they were harsh in their training methods, but they weren't doing it with bad intention necessarily. I mean, I can't make a judgment on my old instructor and what his intentions were. I just remember how I perceived it, which was not pleasant.
Yeah.
But there are those mentalities where, you know, you're tough and you kind of push them around and you make them mentally strong as well. It's not my preferred way of teaching. I think that, you know, fun and creativity is much more, it's much more developmental. You know what I mean? You can really get places if you're creative. And I was very hesitant in those early years. And I feel like I could have made a lot more ground up had I have not been so intimidated to go to class.
Yeah.
But I was...
Right, that's interesting. If you're being put off from developing your skills, it's one thing to get knocked out in your first tournament and have some doubts, but that's in your tournament. That's not in the day-to-day, a week in, week out. You're going to be there. That's where you're going to develop. If you're being put off there, then that's a completely different thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was aware that my parents were so proud that I was doing it, you know what I mean? And then... The other thing as well is when you tell people that you started something, I've always been one of those people that once I've declared that I've started something, then I'm going to see it through.
It's one of the reasons, as much as it'll annoy me, I don't mind the mates of mine who will post every time they've gone for a run or post their times or distance. At first, I was like, just do it and enjoy yourself. But then I realised that's what motivates you, because it's having to tell someone that you've done it. And I think that can be an important thing in all sorts of walks of life, is if you've got someone to answer to, if you've got a mate who's going to ask you every week, oh, how's that thing you said you were going to do coming along, it motivates you more to do it than if you're just
how's your diet going,
kind of want to exactly. There's loads of them that it's why people use social media in that way, as annoying as it can be to people who are following on Instagram or whatever, but it pushes you forward. So you'd made that commitment, so despite the bully.
The thing was as well, I knew that at some point in the future there was going to be a transition, because the class was divided in half, so the younger kids worked with Paul and the older kids and the adults worked with Mick, and I always watched what they were doing. I was in complete awe, because I mean, Mick at the time was, so I mean, I was what, 7, and Mick was about 22, so you know, he wasn't you know, a man by any means. He was still very much an enthusiast. I mean, that was when I started my pro career. That seemed like a lifetime ago. So you know, I watched what he was doing, the way he was teaching and his enthusiasm. And although I wasn't being taught by him, I could connect with that. And I was just, I was kind of passing the time until I reached that.
It's hugely aspirational and relatable, right? If you're seeing someone that's doing all this stuff and is within that age range, rather than the old haggard pro who never made it or whatever else, when you're seeing someone, like, this guy's got the world at his feet.
And yeah.
I want to be that.
And the thing is, at the time, it was unlikely I'd seen anybody that that could actually do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't watching martial arts movies when I was five. I was watching the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, yeah.
And we that was before Power Rangers, so there was none of that nonsense.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know what I mean? So I was literally the only people I'd seen throwing these kicks were Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
So to actually be in a room watching a human being do it,
yeah,
all of a sudden it felt attainable, and I felt like I wanted to train with him. And then there was a point where the club split, and I obviously went with Mick, and that was the beginning of something entirely different. And it was when I got into my, going back to your very original question about my granddad, it was when I got into my early teens that it wasn't convenient. My parents couldn't get me to all the classes that I wanted to go to, so my grandfather started to offer. And after a few years of coming and literally just sitting watching, he would sit for 2 hours, 3 days a week, and just watch me train. The drive was 45 minutes there and back, so it was a good chunk of time that I got to spend with him. And I mean, my granddad was obviously very instrumental in my life all the way through. I mean, my parents were 17 when I was born.
Oh right, wow.
So I lived with my grandparents and my mum for the first 3 years of my life. So yeah, to be able to have that time, and I was always quite special for him to him as well. I mean, he's got five grandkids, he loves them all, but I was the only boy, and we just connected. He also had three daughters.
And
so
you were the one that they was getting to watch being turned into a killing machine. That's every man's dream of any of their lineage. If they're not able to do that themselves, look at what this kid can do.
Yeah. Yeah, so he was 60, I think. Yeah, he was 60, and he said to Mick, "I'd love to be able to do this." And Mick said, "Well, why don't you?" So he trained for 5 years.
Oh wow, and it was amazing.
And it was that difficult time where everybody goes through it when you sort of 13 to about 17 or 18, where you can quite easily be distracted by anything at all.
Yep.
And I could have quite easily been distracted by a lot of stuff. I mean, I started and quit drinking in that window as well.
Right. Yeah.
You know. And it was my grandfather that was kind of an anchor in the martial arts. I mean, he kept me in the martial arts. The book's dedicated to him, and a good portion of the photographs are of him as well.
Yeah.
And what was unfortunate was that I lost him at a really unfortunate time. Was 4 weeks before I fought Joe St. Pierre.
Right.
So it was. Oh, it was his funeral, and then I flew out to New Jersey for the fight. So it was a really, really difficult time, and he was always a real strong pillar. You know, he was a pillar of strength for me.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, my parents were concerned, they were worried. They were confident that I had skills, but there's always that concern that something terrible can happen.
Completely. Parents are always...
Yeah.
Again, I have that. I think I'm not sure if I've mentioned this on the podcast or not before, but obviously I'm trying to do acting in that at the moment, and I've got the podcast. Every now and then I'll still get a message off my mum going, remember, like, music's your actual job and that, so try and get something written and done, because in her mind it's still, that's your career at the moment. I'm doing other stuff and it might work, but it might not. But there's always that little that innocent concern of remember what you do for a living kind of thing.
So I mean, you know, they were obviously concerned, and also because I'd quit university to follow my dream without wanting to sound cheesy, but you know, I was working two jobs and I was training as much as I could. And yeah, and obviously, you know, everybody you meet, there's always a question of, oh, you know, that sounds dangerous. That sounds, you know, how do you know you're going to win? Aren't you afraid? And that kind of thing. The only person that was always consistent was my grandfather.
Right.
So, and there were times when I was, you know, I was starting to get a few, you know, fight week jitters or whatever, and I was feeling a bit anxious, or, you know, I was having a bad training camp. I would just go and see him, and I would sit with him, and he, you know, he'd ask me a few questions about it, and he was just, it was so matter of fact. There was no doubt, you know what I mean? He's like, well, I feel sorry for him. I mean, he knows he don't know what's coming to him. It's that kind of attitude, and I just needed that sometimes, just to be able to go and sit and listen to someone go, of course you're going to win.
Yeah.
You know, it's not even a question. Like, I'm not questioning it, and look how old and wise I am, you know.
It's picking the right... the right outlook, isn't it? I remember, like, when I first started watching a UFC, I was living at home with my mum still, and she'd watch every now and then, and she'd see someone being beaten up and go, who would choose to do that? And my argument would be, no one, because everyone's choosing to be the guy that's doing the beating. Everyone who's a fighter is watching that going, I'm that one.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not looking at the one at the bottom getting beaten up going, I want to do that.
That's
so
true. Look
at this guy.
That's so true. I've said that so many times. It's so true.
Yeah.
And that's what a knockout can do to you. You know, when you're knocked out, all of a sudden you start seeing fights from another perspective.
Yeah.
And if you can't break that, that's when you're condemned. That's when your days are numbered.
Yeah.
You know?
So, I mean, we're sitting here now and... you're a very calm and lucid and intelligent approach to fighting, and you're speaking of you're coming into it being very disciplined and it drawing you away from any negativity. That's not the Dan Hardy I first became introduced to in the UFC, or maybe in Cage Warriors, I guess.
Yeah.
The kind of the birth of the outlaw, was that something you kind of, you built a character for yourself, or was it your natural kind of the youth of cockiness building and a certain a bravado? Because you were one of the first I remember that would really, as we were saying, would call people out, would talk shit a bit, would take the piss, would talk your way in into fights. And I guess that was kind of ahead of Chael at the time as well. Ahead of Chael really getting his voice, because Chael in the WEC was a gentleman, as far as I remember, and then it wasn't until he started to get ignored in the UFC that he started to become this amazing speaker. So, so where did that kind of start to come from?
I think it developed very organically.
Yeah.
You know, if I look back to even my later Taekwondo tournaments, like we were laughing about it the other day, Mick was saying, I just the one thing I could never do was get you to shut your mouth. we're at Olympic trials. We're like, you know, we've prepared for ages, for weeks. We're there for the Olympic trials.
Yeah.
And I'm cussing the guy across the mats. And, you know, like, brilliant. Judges in suits with shirts and ties, like the full setup. And I'm going, fucking come on then, let's fight. Let's right now. Let's, you know, like try.
Yeah.
It was just, and I also walked around with my full contact fighter hoodie on, like the old Miletic guys. You know what I mean? I really like to kind of play that game, you know. And the other thing is what I used to do, which I don't know whether it ever had an effect. I always used to make sure that whatever I showed up in was matching sponsors. Matching brand, so it looked like I was sponsored.
Brilliant.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because that's brilliant.
Like, you walk on the mat as an amateur jiu-jitsu tournament looking like a sponsored fighter and people go, oh, he's going to be good.
It's how I started my career. When I wrote my first I made a little album and I made it off my own money and printed it out, and then all the gigs I did up north,
because
I wanted to turn up with an album. I'd wear a suit on stage so I looked like, so they would assume he must be a big down south. I'd never done a gig in my life down south, but I went up there kind of going, I'm clearly a professional, so it's good to have me on this open mic or whatever. And it's giving that's
genius.
That view and opinion.
Yeah,
it's exactly the same. If you're turning up in all matching gear, it's like, damn, this is people know about this guy.
Yeah. It was like fake it till you make it, isn't it? I mean, it's the old saying. I mean, I did. I wore matching stuff and I wanted to kind of appear like I was this established professional, you know. I even set up a lot of my early sponsors, I never said this, I even set up a fake manager with an email, and I would deal with people through a different name.
Yeah.
You know, and just that kind of stuff was all very organic to me. I felt like it was very much a part of the job.
Yeah.
And then when I started fighting consistently on Cage Warriors, that's when I was able to, because I was getting those, you know, those repeat fans, I was seeing the same people over and over again. And I always liked doing crazy stuff with my hair. It was partly a way of getting my mind prepared for the fight. Mm. You know, I mean, the mohawk came a little bit later, but early on, I was getting, like, patterns shaved in, I had the outlaw shaved in at one point, I had a dragon, I had all kinds of stuff. Contact lenses, that was an early one as well.
It's something to make you distinctive and make you stand out. And again, it's completely comparable. If there's a 6'4" guy with a beard at the open mic, that's an easy reference. Oh, the big guy, you know, it's that thing that can stand out rather than just another person. And I think it was Russell Brand was the first person who said to me about the Simpson theory and approach that every Simpson character you can recognise from a silhouette. And that's a really key psychological thing. It's why Russell started to have his big hair, so he'd have a recognisable silhouette. At that point, you could go through Amy Winehouse and all these different people that you would recognise are from their silhouette, that were easy to become iconic and household names because it's so distinctive.
I didn't even think of that. I mean, I always the one thing that I always kept consistent was red.
Yeah.
You know, I dyed my hair red, I wore red trunks. The only time I strayed away from it was Thai boxing, and I went with hot pink just to mix it up.
Big.
but the red was always, you know, something that I wanted to keep consistent, partly because it was my favourite colour and Raphael was my favourite Ninja Turtle.
Great.
And partly because there was a study I read a while back about the percentage of successful sports teams and athletes predominantly wear red.
Right, so that's interesting.
I mean, it's a worthwhile investment. Even if it's worth nothing, it's worth a shot, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember the one time, because as a teen I used to have mohawks and dye my own hair and stuff like that, and the one time I went and paid to have rebellious hair done, which I regretted afterwards. It's like, if you're ever paying someone to be crazy enough, that it feels a bit weird. You're going into a nice salon, but it was to have red and black because of Rufio from Hulk. It's a massive look. It's so anarchic. Yeah. I loved it.
I always wanted liberty spikes. That was something I never did. But I might grow the mohawk back one day. Yeah. You never know. If I fight again, it'll come back.
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't want to go through everything that I picked up on in the book that I like, but you go into obviously the trash talking with Marcus Davis, Mike Swick, GSP, all of this. I don't want to go over all of that because people should buy the book because it's dope. but that's all in there. But what I do want to talk about is, you've mentioned it a few times, is the reptilian self and what that's all come post your fighting career. And again, there seems to be a greater connection and understanding of yourself. So explain that a little bit. And we touched upon it a bit last time, and I remember hearing you talk to Rogan about it. But still, I think it's a fascinating area to.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm still very much trying to understand it myself. It all started off with a Carl Sagan book, Dragons of Eden, and he talks about the tree and brain and the different developments of the brain and the function they served, and then I started to become very interested in psilocybin, and I started to experiment with different doses of that, and that led me on to Terence McKenna, and he talked about how the introduction of psilocybin could have possibly been one of the precursors to the development of the brain. I mean, the brain size jumped dramatically at a certain period in our history, and you know, there's still not a definitive answer as to why. And Terence McKenna equates it to the diminishing of the rainforests and as having to diversify our food sources. So there's no longer fruit, so we have to start looking for grubs and roots and various different things, which then would possibly have led to, you know, eggs becoming, you know, a part of our diet, or, you know, animal proteins maybe. But another thing that would have most likely have been a part of our diet, at least somewhere in the world, would have been mushrooms.
Yeah.
I mean, we find them everywhere, and a good portion of them are psychoactive.
Yeah.
So the introduction of mushrooms would have surely have had some very profound effect on this early species of 100%. Ours. And I mean, Terence McKenna goes off on all kinds of tangents about it, you know, about sizes of social groups, and you know, obviously, you know, a social group would have been about 100 or 150 at the time, and how, you know, there would have been so much crossbreeding and the ceremonial use of mushrooms around a fire would have led to all kinds of different developments, and obviously, you know, encounters with each other in different levels,
of
and
course, yeah.
The development of language and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And what took me back to the Carl Sagan, the Dragons of Eden stuff, was obviously, you know, dwelling in a sport of combat where you're forced into a fight or flight situation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, when you sign a contract, you're choosing to fight, so you're preparing for it, which is a very different situation to somebody coming up to you on the street and swinging for you.
Yeah.
Because that's an instant decision. You didn't know you were going to be faced with that decision, and you have to make it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
when you have to, even when I was at school, I remember having to make a decision, you know, at the beginning of a maths lesson, whether I'm going to fight the kid sitting across the room from me at the end of the lesson, and then sit him for 50 minutes, like, you know, tying myself in knots, trying to figure out what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very different circumstance when you sign that contract and you are weeks ahead and you start preparing for a person that you can research and watch footage of and really pull apart.
Yeah.
And I always like to over-prepare. I'm one of those kind of people that, especially with training camp, I really used to like to kind of get into it and organise it and make sure I had everything covered. I wanted to know their shoe size and how often they ate and, you know, how much they pissed when they went to the toilet. And I needed to know everything about this person because I was going to take them apart. And that was my sole focus for 8 weeks or whatever it was I was using. So when I started to realise that different parts of my brain were advising me in different ways, it allowed me to separate the voices, and I wasn't able to do that. It sounds like I'm a lunatic, separate the voices. I wasn't able to do that until I started to experiment with psilocybin.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that it's not achievable in other ways, because I'm certain it is.
But
because I wasn't aware of it, I couldn't have had knowledge of it.
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean?
It's how it's brought to your attention and the situation in which you experience it and open things up. I've got another podcast on the network called Say Why to Drugs, and me and a doctor called Dr. Susie Gage, who studies recreational drugs, picks a drug every week and discusses it, and discusses the influence on the brain and the influence on the on the body, the positives and the negatives, the dangers, the reasons they're great. and one of the things that's come up in almost all of them is set and setting as being absolutely key to any drug. That even heroin in the right set and setting is wildly different, or in two different sets and settings is wildly different.
Yeah.
It's a completely different beast. And we've got, I don't think it's going to be out yet when it drops, but if it is, it's either just come out or coming out very soon. We just broke down DMT. And again, we've previously done mushrooms and LSD and that kind of thing, and look at these different things. And it was fascinating to discuss DMT because it's so hard to break down, because everyone who tends to use it in a very spiritual way.
Yeah.
Now, it's hard to say if the reason, the difference for the experiences on that are different from the experiences on mushrooms or on LSD are because the drugs have different effects, or because you're preparing your mind in a different way to go into it. Mm. If you're taking this particular drug, and ayahuasca is one of the most popular ones, on DMT and all this kind of thing, you're generally doing it in a very tribalistic manner and a ritualistic manner.
Yeah.
If you're taking some acid at a party on a beach or in a club, it's like, that's going to be a completely different experience. So it's a fascinating area to kind of,
it really is,
delve into and look at.
I got completely sucked into that, and I was trying to read as much as possible. And there's some really, really interesting stuff out there. There's some really wacky stuff as well. Yeah. You know, it goes off on different tangents. And
it's one of the things that Susie Gage talked about. She said there's tons of great research on DMT and things like that, but the one thing that annoyed her was one of the doctors that had done a study on it described LSD and mushrooms as a trip of the mind or a trip of the brain, and ayahuasca or DMT as a trip of the soul. And her annoyance with that was, you're a fucking scientist. What the fuck is a soul? Like, that's not something that's scientifically definable. I know what you're saying and where you're going with that, but if you're doing a scientific study, you can't use spiritualistic terminology as such. But that tends to be what people feel or say about those things. But again, it can teach you a lot of stuff. And I said, depending on the manner in which you find it, it can open your eyes to a lot of things that, as you said, you could have found other ways, or there might have been in other teachings or readings or learnings. But that's,
I think that, like, the states that you achieve with some kind of psychedelic substance, you can reach, I'm sure, with other ways. I mean, you know, the old stories of these guys disappearing into a cave in the mountains for 40 years and meditating, you know, fasting is another one. And I mean, self-flagellation, even if you go back into, like, you know, old time Italy and the Catholic Church, they used to beat the shit out of themselves. And there's definitely something with pain that takes you very close to that space. Yeah. And sometimes people do like to connect with pain. I mean,
yeah.
Are they called fakirs? The people that like to shove rods and hooks through their skin?
Right, yeah.
I always remember an artist called Stellark who showed up to my university once. Yeah. He was this off-the-wall Australian guy who was... He had a third ear attached so he could hear the internet. Or He was real crackpot. He was fascinating.
Yeah.
But he was one of those guys that did a lot with stuff with hooks.
Right.
And, you know, it hooks in the skin being suspended and... I'm sure there are different ways of achieving it. I feel that people are reaching out for those alternative methods, which are far more extreme and damaging, because we've lost the connection with the planet.
Yeah, sure, that makes sense.
I mean, people putting themselves through pain or fasting or you know, hours of like silence and meditation or however they get there. The keys are growing in the earth. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like you can. Well, we at least used to be able to pick mushrooms ourselves, be able to identify them, and know how to work with them as well, which is a technology which is lost.
Completely.
I mean, fortunately, ayahuasca is starting to get a foothold in the mainstream now.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that's an ancient technology that we still can't understand. I mean, how did they know to combine these two organic substances to achieve this? I mean, it's absolutely fascinating, and the depth of that tradition as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been fortunate enough to go to Peru a couple of times. The last time I was there, we're actually exactly a year ago today.
Right.
And I've also had ayahuasca ceremonies on an Indian reserve in California.
Yeah.
And I've also, you know, I've also had it in someone's front room in Vegas. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't need to tell you which one was the most profound and spiritual of them all, but...
Yeah. Everyone loves Vegas.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But... You know, there's definitely something that we're missing, that we've lost the connection, and a lot of people around the world are reaching out to reestablish that connection, and most of them don't even know they're doing it.
Yeah.
That's what's fascinating about it. The amount of people that are contacting me, I have professional fighters send me messages about dosages and this and that. And I mean, I'm no expert. I can only talk from my own experience, which I've been wide open with in the book. There's a whole chapter on it. So... I really feel like this needs to be talked about more. It needs to be brought into the mainstream, and we need to be talking about these things.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, another way people are reaching for this is using chemical compounds, which is something that I have no interest in.
Yeah.
Everything that I work with is organic. You know, it's mushrooms or ayahuasca or obviously marijuana. I still think it, you know, is a very powerful medicine if used correctly.
Yeah, and again, it's one of the reasons we do the Say Why to Drugs podcast, because it's to try and talk about drugs without that demonization of drugs are bad. And again, I say in the trailer, which has probably been played at the beginning of this, so it will annoy people that I'm repeating it now, but it's not pro-drugs, it's not anti-drugs, it's pro-truth and anti-myth.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the point of it, just going, look, imagine if drugs weren't these scary, evil things. Because, spoiler alert, they're not.
Yeah.
It's just what we're told, and it's a myth. But imagine if they weren't, then... Or we could look at them and approach them for their benefits and be cautious of them for their dangers, rather than just stay away from them. That's bad. So, how's that kind of all that mental change influenced you in your training, in your approach to fighting? Do you feel, if you are to get to return, do you feel this is a completely new Dan Hardy out there?
Yes, yeah. I think one of the main motivating factors for me wanting to fight again is because I don't feel like I've given a good account of myself in the UFC.
Yeah.
I mean, I can look back to performances that I had before I got to the UFC, and obviously the opposition was not as good, but my performances were better.
Right.
I looked better, I felt better, I moved better, I was technically far superior in striking than I was in the UFC.
Like,
I watched my old fights in the UFC, and I think I look slow, I look sluggish, I look cumbersome. That's I got too big, I got too heavy.
Right.
You know, because I went from fighting, you know, 15 times a year to fighting 3 times a year.
Right.
And, you know, fighting so regularly kept me sharp all the time. I was always in training camp. Every week I was running, you know what I mean? There was not a time when I would stop and go, okay, now I've got to detrain and you know, sit down for 3 days, and then I can start slowly building my aerobic base up while I'm doing powerlifting. You know what I mean? It was like... that didn't come until I reached the UFC, and it dramatically changed the way that I thought.
At the level of subconscious sharpness, essentially, from being constantly in it, that you wouldn't have noticed. You'd feel you've gone in and done a camp as well as you used to do them. It's just the fact that you used to do them throughout the whole year. So this potentially isn't having as much of an impact. Yeah,
it was the break that was really. I mean, I really felt like it upset me. And obviously, when I crossed over to the UFC, and there was much more of a, well, a lot of the opponents were bigger. Let's put it that way. And I always wanted to make sure I was at least strong enough and big enough to make it difficult for them to throw me around.
Yeah,
if they were going to. Yeah. I mean, if you look at me facing off with GSP, you know, although I couldn't put up much of an offensive in the grappling range, I was still big and strong.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Definitely.
There was a lot of me in comparison to now.
Yeah.
And I just don't really think it suited my fighting style. I think looking back, I could have really done with a weight class in between welterweight and lightweight.
Yeah.
And if I'd have been smart and stayed in shape all year round like I should have done,
mm-hmm.
then I think that you know, I mean, that I keep mentioning it. I think we need a couple more weight classes.
Yeah.
You know, I think we need a light welterweight. I think 161 is perfect. Because with that £1 allowance to 162, that puts it bang in the middle of the two.
I mean, it's become... I mean, the UFC have made it very clear that they're not afraid of belts, with everyone getting an interim belt these days.
I'm waiting for one to come through the door. I'm not receiving mine yet.
it makes sense to have those middling weight classes.
Yeah.
Then you can have a belt headline in every event because you've got more weight classes.
More champions, that means the depth across the planet will get deeper.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of guys that fought at welterweight, but they just weren't big enough and were discouraged, but could never make lightweight. You know what I mean? I know a lot of those guys. And it goes through the weight classes.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, obviously, the bigger the weight classes get, the bigger the gap between them. And we could do with a few more champions. And I always felt like the additional weight that I put on to be a big welterweight didn't suit me. And could I have done it again, I would have been closer to my more natural weight and just been smaller.
Yeah.
I really would.
Yeah, you know, the Frankie Edgar
approach
of not cutting weight, just going in and being the best you.
Yeah.
And hoping that can, in theory, that cancels out any size advantage.
Yeah.
Before we move on to talking about the London card, because we will wrap up at some point. Last time we sat down and did this, it turned into two podcasts and we chatted for over 3 hours. So I'm going to rein it in this time.
Yeah.
But Ring Rust, talking to you, it sounds like that wouldn't be an issue because of the mental approach and the physical approach. And I think Ring Rust is a real thing, but I also think it's something that's counterable. And I think, and now, again, I've brought him up before, but a great example of that is Dominic Cruz. The fact that when he was off, he was an analyst. He was breaking down fights. He was keeping his mind sharp. So when he came back, although he got injured again, but when he came back again, he looked like he was better than when he left. Mm. He was, you know, he had improved in that time. So is that a way you feel you are and you'd be? Or would you... Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't look for a warm-up fight, because if you're only looking at two or three more fights, you'd...
No, I wouldn't be looking for warm-up fights. And I also wouldn't be really looking for... You know, a fight that's announced and you know, ahead of time and having a full training camp.
Right.
What I want to do, what would be ideal for me now, is especially now my new rig's installed, I'm going to get myself to about 85% condition.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to hold that.
Yeah.
I'm just going to hold that because that's what I was when I was competing all the time.
Yeah.
I'm going to see roughly where my weight is. I'm lighter naturally now than I was back then. Anyway, I've lost a lot of the unnecessary weight. I mean, my legs used to be so much heavier and thicker. So. You know, I've slimmed down. I feel a lot quicker and leaner and lighter now, and I'm walking around at 185.
Mm-hmm.
But I've still got a bit of Christmas dinner around my waist to go.
Yeah.
And I know I could make lightweight. I've made 160 a couple of times in my career. So I just want to kind of get within sort of 20 pounds of the weight and sit there comfortably at 80-85% condition, and then
be ready if something.
Yeah. If just, you know, a massive fight is going down and one of the opponents happens to pull out, and I can just, I mean, you know, obviously there are a lot of guys out there that would be wanting to take that fight, but I could also throw my name in the hat.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is because it's been so long since I've fought, people are kind of romanticising the good parts of my career over time.
Right,
and
sure.
They're more enthusiastic about me fighting now than they were then.
Yeah.
You know?
I maintain if the Libertines had never split up, oh, they wouldn't have headlined Reading and Leeds. Because they did, it came back as this, oh my God, this is the, it's a similar thing. You put that romance on it, but regardless of any romance or not, you are someone who's been in championship fights, who's fought many names that have gone on to be, you know, iconic and big names. So yeah, it keeps you in there.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's interesting, and I think it's favourable for me because it does allow me to get bigger, more exciting fights.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fascinating. I think it's down to the fact that I have been working as an analyst, and I think people have, they've got to know me a bit better. They understand me more as a person now instead of just the character that they would see around fight time. I mean, that's the thing is, if I was fighting and you saw Embedded, that would be the guy that you would see because around fight time, that's who I am.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's nothing contrived about it, but I certainly turn the volume up on some parts of my personality.
Of course, yeah.
The outlaw comes out a little bit. Yeah. I like living in that space, but I can't do it all year round. Yeah. It's exhausting.
Yeah.
And right. Nobody likes me.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be an intense situation, but before we have a look at the London card, the book comes out on the 23rd of March. Yep. I'll have links in this to buy it from Amazon or wherever else. And you're doing a load of sign-ins, so you're starting off in Nottingham, of course, on the 22nd of March. How exciting is that, though,
it's going to be awesome
with a book? Because, again, there's when you strive to be an athlete or in combat sports, there's certain things that are your goals and achievements, but a book generally isn't on that list. It's not something you particularly expect. So does that kind of, is it good to be starting off at home with that kind of
thing? It is. And it couldn't be more perfect, really. I'm sure that basically it'll just be me and my family crowding Waterstones for a couple of hours talking about old times. But yeah, it's going to be awesome.
I'm sure it won't. I remember when I played in Nottingham, it wasn't the one that you came to, but it was when we were in rescue rooms, and it was the Friday before you fought JSP. Okay. And I gave you a shout out to the crowd then, and they went nuts.
Yeah.
Because the local boy was fighting for a title. But yeah, so you're there, and then you're going to Manchester. You'll be at Leadenhall in London, in Birmingham, in Dublin, in Edinburgh, and in Glasgow. Yeah. You're doing Edinburgh and Glasgow in the same day. That's good. They're so near. That'll be good fun.
And then I'm going to take a little bit of a drive around the Highlands. I've never been to the coast of the north of England.
So I've gone a few hours past. I've gone up to Aberdeen and a few places like that. But yeah, it's beautiful up there. My brother, again, in fact, as this goes out, he's going to a hut up in the Highlands that hasn't got any. He's spending a week there. It's got no power. It's got no hot water. So it's got a stove, a wood burning stove. And yeah, I hadn't realised the intensity of it until he was around a couple of days ago. And he was like, oh, I'm not going to have to charge my phone. And I knew there wasn't any internet. I was like, oh, is there no power? He's like, yeah, there's no hot water either. There's a contraption to boil the water and have a shower outside and all this kind of stuff. I was like, man, I love that. It's crazy that we don't realise that the Highlands just this amazing, it's the kind of,
bit of a wilderness.
There's
really
so much there.
Yeah, but that's what I was talking about a minute ago. People trying to connect with something, trying to find that connection point.
Because he also, he did a 10-day fast at one point as well. So no food, only water.
Wow.
And he said on that, he said, for mental clarity, he didn't particularly feel it until he started to come off of the fast. And you come off with nuts first and stuff like that and build yourself up. You can't just go, I'm going to eat a pizza because your body will literally die. But he said it was like a mist coming over his head. He said the mental clarity he developed when fasting was absolutely mind-blowing.
Wow.
But because it comes in gradually and you're a bit nervous and focused on the fact that you're weaning off food and all this kind of thing. Yeah, it was interesting. Mm. But yeah, anyway, when I had Rory McDonald on, he kind of implied that the Bellator London card is better than the UK London card, and it is really good. But I was talking to a mate of mine the other day who's going, and he's a casual fan, and he was saying, "Oh, it's not the best card." It's why I'm excited to talk to you about it, because I think there's fights that you'll be as excited as I am about.
Yeah.
And I think the first time I met you, it was at a UFC London. And it was another card that people at the time were like, oh, it's not that good. Stevenson was headlining.
Right.
Like, you weren't fighting, but I'm sure it was one that you were... but on that one, a guy that... Or two guys no one had really heard of called Chael Sonnen and Damian Maia fought. And it's one of these that it was an amazing night. But, let's have a quick go through a few of them. I mean, the main event, Amanda and Anderson, is hugely exciting. And Jimmy just looked astounding in his last fight, didn't he? Do you think he's now getting to that point where he's at that level? Because he started really late and he blitzed through people on the UK scene, and then he jumped into the UFC and had to fight some of the best fighters in the history of light heavyweight. And it felt like he'd maybe been exposed, but I think no, he'd just been putting against some... Absolute beasts.
I mean, it wasn't really. It wasn't until he reached the UFC that there was really any kind of competition for him. You know, so it was. He didn't even up until the UFC, he didn't really know what he was preparing for, because what he had was adequate.
You know,
that's something that people forget, is when somebody gets to the UFC and they're unbeaten, what they've got is already adequate for what they want to do.
So
when they get to the UFC, sometimes people get a massive shock.
100%.
I mean, Jimmy wasn't one of those guys. I mean, if you look back to his fight against Kyle Kingsbury, for example, Kyle's a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
You know, that was just a brutal beatdown of probably, the biggest light heavyweight, aside from Forrest Griffin, I would say. Kyle, he's massive.
Yeah.
You know, and then he had a couple of frustrating ones, didn't he? He had two, was it knee injuries? Was it Cyril?
Yeah.
And then Ryan Jimmo?
Yeah. Rest in peace. Both of those,
You know, so...
And again, it felt like he was just... with Kyle Kingsbury, I think he stayed in his corner, didn't he? It was one of them where he couldn't continue, I think. And
fractured skull, wasn't it? It was a bad injury.
Yeah,
I know that.
Yeah, it was brutal. And yes, so he had these ones where he's winning, but it's not always the showcase or the experience even that he needed to.
Yeah, and it's not, not always challenging for him. I mean, a couple of those wins were very frustrating because he didn't get the finish that he wanted. And I also think, since he's been training over at All Stars, training with Gus, that's changed him exponentially. Really? I went over there. We were filming some stuff a little while ago for the UFC, and I got in there and I was training with them a little bit, and he just knows mixed martial arts much better now. And that's really what he needed. He needed to understand that he has all the skills and the tools and the ability.
But there's
still more to learn.
Yeah.
There's still more you can add to your game. You need some scrambles. You need some good takedown defense. You need to threaten off your back. He's a great striker. Technically, he's a very, very good striker. He's very smooth. He puts his combinations together very well. I would like to see him, throw a little more. I'd like to see him throw a bit more volume. But when you've got a guy that hits that hard, sometimes they just can't hold back that power. It's like Tyron Woodley.
Yeah.
He has so much power that when he decides to punch, it's all or nothing.
Yeah.
So that is a massive drain on his conditioning, and I think that's something else that he's had to negotiate since he's signed with the UFC as well. And I think he's right at that point now where he knows what he needs to do to get to where he wants to be.
It's one of the things that I think is underrated about Yoel Romero is his patience with his power. And again, it's partly because he's a bit older and might not have the stamina, but he's one that I remember his first couple of fights in the UFC, I was entranced because he had this kind of, it looked like he was almost moving in slow motion, and he'd have this weird bob from side to side that looked so slow, and then he'd explode. And I mean, the Weidman one, where I'm convinced that it was Weidman that stopped Rommel damaging the ceiling of the arena, because that knee was just, it felt like he was just going to keep going, and it had that explosiveness. So if you can learn to pick and choose when you use that, rather than just wing it out there, that's deadly.
It is, and Jimmy's very good at distributing his power over all of his strikes as well. Even a great striker, even someone that's got a lot of knockouts, like Paul Daly, for example, is a good example. Loads and loads of knockouts on his record. But if you look down his record, if you watch those fights, the majority are left hooks.
Mm-hmm.
He has a ridiculous left hook.
Yeah.
And because it's become such a weapon, like Tyron Woodley's right hand, his sprint, like I talked about in the breakdown, the 2-1-2 sprint that he does, he throws the short right hand, short lead, and then over the top to crack him on the temple. because it's worked so many times, it's the go-to.
Yeah.
Derek Brunson with the over and over again with the left hand until they fall over.
Yeah.
Jimmy's not fallen into that trap.
Roy Nelson is one that's the ultimate example of that. I remember a watcher, one of his fights with someone who hadn't watched many fights. I said, literally, let's count how many... I don't think we even counted how many times he threw his overhand right. We counted how many times he threw anything other than his overhand right, and it just wasn't there. It was just. But again, if you've got that,
yeah.
If you can put
sometimes
people
you
like
just
that,
gravitate
it be,
towards
yeah.
it, you know, without thinking about it. And I credit Jimmy for not doing that because he could. He could gravitate towards one weapon, but because he's able to mix it up, that's what's going to make him a world-class contender.
Yeah.
You know, and Corey Anderson as well. I've been researching him for the breakdown show that we're going to do next week. That he moves very well. You know, when I first saw the matchup and thought about him, I pictured him as being a lot more rigid and stiff than he is.
Yep.
But he actually fights very, very well going backwards.
Right.
And I think that's going to be a key in this fight because obviously Jimmy is an always push forward kind of fighter. He can be patient, but he does like to be progressing.
Yeah, definitely.
So if somebody's going to negate that power and stay conscious fighting Jimmy, it's going to be someone that can move back and use a good reach, use that jab, and always threaten with the power double.
And pick up, yeah.
And Corey Anderson's that guy.
Yeah.
You know, and once he gets on top, he's very, very good at sitting in guard and half guard. He'll sit in half guard, he'll turk the leg, and he'll cross body control and just beat you up against the fence.
Yeah, he's got a good. His calmness on top seems to be. There's a lack of urgency, but in a way that he's waiting for that. Like, he doesn't want to scramble and rush to beat. It's like there's that constant pressure, I guess.
Yeah. And he's very calculated in what he's doing as well. One of the things I'm going to talk about on the breakdown, I'll mention it now,
is,
if you watch his fight against Jan Błachowicz, who's a very, very good fighter, who threatened him with an armbar in the first round.
Yeah.
If you watch that fight, you'll see how not only does he keep him square against the fence with his hips, but he forces him so cramped that Jan has to pick a side, which then brings his head closer to his hip to hit him with elbows.
Yeah.
And he does it consistently throughout his career.
Amazing, yeah.
He's got a very good ability of pinning somebody's hips square, but forcing their head to one side or the other. And Khabib does the same thing.
Yeah.
We'll likely see it this weekend.
That's great. So, we won't go for every fight, but, I mean, as soon as they announced Gunnar and Joe Bowen, I was like, how can anyone question the strength? I mean, that's a hell of a matchup of two absolute beasts, absolute up-and-comers.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's
very exciting. Alan, his striking has always looked fantastic. He's no slouch on the ground. He's a tenth planet, isn't he?
Yep.
He's no slouch down there. But Gunnar was my favourite fighter for a minute there. He was just so calm and consistent, and just the pressure of him for a not intimidating looking guy, the smothering.
Yeah.
It's why I was kind of sad when he was matched up with Damian Maia, because Damian Maia has been my long time favourite for exactly that pressure, that smothering. It was like, oh man, this is a tough one.
Yeah, you know, it's a great fight, and I mean, I'm looking forward to it because obviously Gunnar's a very unique fighter in the way that he approaches the fights. He's the only fighter that when we've done an inside the octagon, I've not been able to go, let's look at his striking, let's look at his grappling, you know, because you can't separate them.
Yeah.
Everything that he does follows a path, particularly if you watch his first, I think, three, maybe four fights in the UFC.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Demarcus Johnson one, and I can't remember who else he fights now, the names are evading me. But he follows the same path. He sets them up. Zach Cummins is the other one. He sets them up. He lunges in with that karate right hand. He cracks them and stuns them. And then he grabs them and drags them down to the floor.
Yeah.
And he's got
really
that.
Drags as
really
well.
Really does. And if you look at him, if you look at the way he stands and the way he's built, he's built kind of like a hockey player.
Yeah.
He's got a very strong posterior chain, which means that once he's clamped onto you, it's very, very difficult to get him to move.
Yeah.
And he drags people down, he smothers them and slowly progresses, like you said, to a dominant position and then finishes with a choke.
Yeah.
And Alan is a guy that I trained with Alan a long time ago when he was a model before he was a fighter.
Yeah.
And he would come and join our sparring sessions, and he was always very awkward because he was a southpaw, and he was always very athletic, very strong.
Yeah.
And he just seemed to pick Muay Thai up very, very easily.
Yeah.
It was very comfortable for him. He moved very well. And I mean, we had some great sparring sessions, and he was really focused on kickboxing and Muay Thai until he started picking up the ground game, and 10th Planet was in the same place. It was all at Legends,
right,
so
yeah.
It's easy to get addicted to the 10th Planet system.
Yeah,
it's
completely. And I think Alan's a really exciting one because he's had those moments now where he's apt to see if he likes getting punched, and he didn't. Like I remember, I can't think who he was against, but the first time he got caught, he seemed quite shaken. And people talk of Brock not liking getting punched, or Ronda being an example, but you've got to experience it to get through that. And I think in his last fight, he got caught but pushed through and kind of. It feels like he's had that experience now, which is key.
Yeah, he's definitely got the mental toughness. And there was a time when, you know, he did look a little startled for a second, but there was always the intention of fighting back. Do you know what I mean? He was always trying to stay on his feet, trying to get himself into a better position.
Yeah.
And obviously now we've seen him fight through that, and we've started to see the establishment of how strong his elbow game is,
mm-hmm.
which is a massively underutilized tool in mixed martial arts.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the only other person I can think is comparable at the moment really is. Tony Ferguson has got mm-hmm. great elbows,
yeah.
But Condit, if you watch his fight against Alves, I think he lost the first round and then finished him in the second
with
wicked elbows. Alan's got great elbows, and you just look at the guy and you think to yourself, well, I mean, he's and we can't underestimate how successful he is as a male model. I mean, you know, he is the highest of high end of male models. Yeah, he's in there getting.
Is he Armani or Gucci or which? Yeah, I can't think. He's doing very well.
Yeah. So, you know, that was the question for me when he first started coming to the sparring sessions is, you know, well.
How dedicated is this guy?
Yeah.
What does he want to do? Yeah.
Yeah. How far is he going to go with this? Oh, can we punch him in the face? Is that okay? You know? And he always showed a lot of toughness in the gym as well.
That's great.
You know, you wouldn't have thought he had a career, you know, that's supposed to look after his face.
Yeah. I mean, I will dance through a few more. I know which one I want to end on talking about, but. The fight that I'm most excited about and most sad about. I really hated it when Jacare and Romero were paired up because I loved them both and wanted them both. I didn't want one to be eliminated.
Yeah.
And Arnold Allen and Amerikani are two fighters that I think are potential superstars, both of them.
Yeah.
So whilst it's exciting for them to be matched up, I did have a little bit of a, oh man, someone has to lose here. I think Arnold Allen he looks fantastic. I think he's a great example. In a weird way, he reminds me of John Hathaway in coming out of England, in that he feels like very much a mixed martial artist, rather than a lot of the UK guys will be a boxer converting or whatever else. He feels like an all-round mixed martial artist, and he seems, in great shape. And Amerikani is a little superstar in the making with... his post-fight speeches, his wins, his randomly stopping people who were stealing beer in the street and getting it on social media. He's an interesting character
for sure. They're very different as well.
Yeah.
Not only in their character, but in their fighting style. You know, you've got Amerikani, who's a very fast starter. You know what I mean? Obviously, if you think of the Andy Ugal fight, I mean, that was 6 seconds or something. He's a very fast starter. He likes to capitalize on that startled opponent that was just not expecting that rush.
Yeah.
Even if you go back to his earlier fights before he joined the UFC, you can see him very quickly jumping on submissions and just snatching things and cranking stuff on very quickly and getting those panic reactions from fighters. What Arnold Allen's very good at is withstanding an early storm and coming back and getting stronger as the fight goes on, and because
and remaining calm in those
storm. Yeah, and he's also one of those, and you've paired him perfectly with John Hathaway, one of those strong athletes that's just a nice guy.
Yeah.
So no matter what you do or no matter what you say, you're not going to get a reaction out of him. You're not going to be able to shake him because he's just going to be the nice guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
just the calmest, friendliest. He used to roll at the Gracie Baja in Raleigh near me, which I used to go to. And again, it's that thing of, you'd think if there's a UFC or verge of UFC guy there, you'd notice. But again, he's not that guy. He's just there to do his thing. Just a pleasant lad. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a fascinating matchup. I don't think a loss hurts either guy. I mean, I think, and the thing is as well, I know
they're both
that,
really young still, so that's kind of the advantage there, that they've got a long time in the game.
We kind of need to see. It was like Cody Garbrandt against Thomas Almeida.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't want to see either of those guys lose. I wanted to see both of them develop into prospects and contend for the title. But the difference with mixed martial arts and with boxing is that, you know, in boxing, a loss can like send you down a whole different 100%. Path.
Yeah.
In mixed martial arts, it adds to the story. Yeah. It adds to your game. You know, because there are so many ways to lose in mixed martial arts, it's very difficult to get to Khabib level and to be unbeaten, you know, because there are so many mistakes to make. There are so many traps to fall into or ways to get caught. You can't cover yourself entirely. You're always going to get someone that can hit harder than you. You know, it's one of those situations that, you know, if somebody gets to a stage where they've, you know, they've got 15 fights and they're unbeaten, that's a bit strange. Now we need to start trying to find someone to beat them.
And I mean, I argued with some people online when Khabib came back from injury and everyone was saying he deserved a title shot because of his undefeated run, and my opinion was, I think he's amazing, but at that point he hadn't fought that many great people. No. He'd beaten RDA, but so's Clay Guida. Does Clay Guida deserve a title shot? You know, it's these things, and I'm a big fan of Ferguson, but my thought was at that point Ferguson had been beating people at high level all the time while Nurmagomedov was injured.
Yeah.
So it felt,
And he was running through guys as well, wasn't he? Yeah. I mean, you know, like he was making a statement in every outing at the Octagon.
Yeah.
So
there's a couple more, again, for people who are maybe going or maybe thinking of tuning in and unsure. So a few people I want to highlight for casual fans, and one of them is a guy that both of us will have seen a fair bit in Bama, in Dikesi. And the last two fights I saw him in Bama were under a minute, and he just looked like an absolute beast. So I think he's an exciting one, and he made it through his first fight in the UFC, right? And I think again he's an exciting one to have on the card there.
Yeah, a very very talented young prospect, you know, and a guy that
explosive as hell.
Yeah, massively explosive. I mean, well,
and accuracy as well. Was a thing for him. I feel from what I've seen, not one of those just explosive wild swingers. It's a calmness and then bang.
Yeah. Yeah, very. He's got a very old head on him. He's very mature for his for his career. I actually trained with him one time. I went up to ASW where Bradley Scott trains and Mike Wilkinson. Sorry, not Bradley Scott. Scott Askham.
Yeah.
Which is another great fight on the card.
Yeah.
So I went up there and I saw him, and obviously we were focused on Mike Wilkinson and Scott Askham because they were on the card, but. Yeah. Dikesi was there, and he was just a talent that you couldn't help but focus on. You know what I mean? Yeah. You could see how much potential he had. I rolled with him. He was very slick, very smooth, and like you said, very strong and explosive. And I mean, anybody, get on Instagram and take a look at the kid training. Some of the powerlifting that he does is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, and he's a very calm individual as well. Like I say, he's got a very old head on him. So, yes, you know, he's going to go from strength to strength. And what's nice is that he's got a couple of UFC vets in his camp that he's working with that he can also share the experiences with and kind of draw knowledge from. And he's got Darren Morris as well, who is one of the best coaches in the country in Europe, likely. You know, he was training guys for the old submission wrestling tournaments back in, 2002? You know what I mean? Like, he's been around for a long time.
It's a scary combination of a veteran like that and a young kid, as said, who can remain so calm and have such an old head on him. That's a killer. Mm-hmm. That can climb and climb and climb. I remember there was a point where each time Nate Diaz fought, he seemed to have got 10 times better. And it feels, I like that. It feels like combinations, I like that, breed that they might look good in this fight. He's now had 5 more months in the gym.
Yeah.
That's a massive climb. Well, you mentioned Scott and Askham. That's a great fight. A breeze is opening the card, which is always good. Duffy on the card is exciting. But Edwards, I wanted to highlight as well, because I think he looked like he was going to start smashing through things, and it slowed a little. But again, I think he's a great British prospect.
Yeah. The only thing I want to do with Leon is just give him a good shake.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I want to go just go and get it. Just go and take it for yourself. And I always, and the other one of my teammates, love him to death, Andre Winner, was exactly the same.
Yeah.
The amount of times...
You've like, got it all there.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the amount of times, like, 2 minutes into the first round, I just want to... Hang on, sorry, referee. I'm cutting the fight. Just give me a second. Andre.
Yeah.
Go and get it.
Yeah.
You can knock this guy out now. Go and get it.
Yeah. I can't think of what fight, but I remember a Leon Edwards fight or a knockout, in fact, where there was just a moment where he looked like the most surprised person in the thing. He just knocked a person out and he was like... All right, yep, cool. Like, yeah. No, that's how good you are. Yeah.
Seth Brzezinski.
Yeah, it's like, that's how good you are. Go and do that. You should be expecting that.
That's it. It's like he's kind of waiting for that final piece, that fight that proves to himself that he's got the skills to do what he has. I mean, you know, that fight against Seth was really just a glimpse of what he's capable of. And he reminds me of my old Thai boxing coach, Owen Comrie, who was... You know, he's a very relaxed Thai boxer. He had a real kind of calm, cocky style. You know, you were never quite sure what you were letting yourself in for. But Owen, when I was working with him, was obviously maturing his game. So he was setting you up for something. Whereas Leon has that kind of vibe, but sometimes I'm not sure whether he knows what's coming next.
Yeah.
And when he gets that belief in himself, that's when we're going to start seeing some really spectacular finishes from him.
100%. So the last one I want to talk about, and again... As you work for the UFC, it feels cheesy if you're doing a hard sell, but I work for the fuckers, but I can happily say, if you're on the fence of watching this event, then you owe it to MMA to watch Brad Pickett's swan song.
Oh, what, man.
An absolute legend in British MMA and in the UFC, in WEC and everything, been in some of the greatest fights, the fact that he's going out in London,
It's perfect.
I can't wait for that. It's going to be
It's going to be
hair standing on end.
It's going to be emotional. I mean, I hope, you know, obviously, regardless of what happens, I hope he gets a second on the mic. I hope I get to have a brief chat with him.
Yeah,
you know, people don't realize how much Brad has invested in this sport. You know, he's been around for so long. He's had so many fights. He's trained with so many people.
He's brought so many people through as well.
Exactly. I mean, he's got his own show. He's bringing amateurs up. And the sole reason for running this show... His
podcast is fantastic. I'll give give that a shout out as
him and Brian
as we're here with Brian Lacey. Yeah, Brian Lacey. It's great.
Yeah, I just love the guy. And what was nice is my second pro fight down on Portsmouth Pier against Paul Jenkins. That was the main event. Brad was on the card, and I obviously had never heard of him before. Yeah. Little guy comes in with his hat on.
Yeah.
One punch, I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to have to watch this kid.
Was his nose already at that shape?
It was a lot straighter. I actually saw a photograph of him the other day. I didn't recognise him. He was one of his younger fight photos. Yeah. But it was a great fight. I remember coming out of the dressing rooms to watch it, because it was a couple of fights before mine. And... I wanted to come out and watch it just because the way he carried himself, you know, he was just so confident, so sure of himself, and he had a big fan base down there already, everybody wearing the same hats and stuff, so knocked the guy out in one punch, perfect knockout, and then the next time I shared a card with him was in Nottingham, and again, knocked a guy out with one punch, knocked Yves Dubois out with a beautiful uppercut, beautiful uppercut, and I tell you... And right before that, the day before, we're standing backstage at the weigh-ins, and he was saying, I'm gonna knock him out, I'm going to knock him out, and I'm going to do Gangnam Style afterwards. I said, oh, okay. I mean, obviously, you know, Gangnam Style was rife at that point, and I knew that if he did it, the whole Nottingham Arena would go up. But yeah, it just played out perfectly for him.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's one that I can't wait for, and yeah, it's going to be a beautiful one. Before we wrap things up completely then, that's just made me think of someone I want to ask you about, MVP.
Yeah.
I think I've seen him live a few times. I was at the event where he did the Pokemon celebration afterwards, and he seems to have the sky's the limit for that boy. He had a good test in his last fight. He had a rough night out there, and it wasn't... And I'm a fan, and I know him. I'd go as far as to say that was one of the least enjoyable fights I've watched in a while. It wasn't a good night out for him, but he's an amazing fighter, and I'd argue more so than Anderson, even. It's so hard to tell what he's going to do and where it's going to come from. It seems to be just... in a similar way to John Jones, was kind of, he'd been training for 3 years or something, and he was beating everyone in the world, and he was saying how a lot of stuff he'd see in a computer game or so on and so forth. I did a thing at Comic-Con interviewing a Michael Venom Page, and he was saying exactly that. He was saying, I often play computer games to get ideas, and I'll see the way a character moves or something, and I'll go, I could do something with that.
Yeah.
That's mind-blowing to me.
It is, you know, and he's one of those, just like John Jones, he's one of those people that is that very, very fortunate combination of physical ability and creative-mindedness.
Yeah, yeah.
And we don't see that very often, particularly in a sport of mixed martial arts where everyone's always trying to do what is safest.
Yeah.
Because you can really get hurt in this sport.
Mm.
So when you have someone who takes risks, and Anderson Silva obviously is a great example, who took risks and paid for it later on in his career. But even Anderson Silva was orthodox in the most unorthodox way.
Completely.
You know, just like Roy Jones.
It annoys me when people say that Anderson threw that fight away for it. It's like, no, he did what he's been hugely successful for his whole career.
Yeah. What people loved him for.
Yeah. It wasn't him being silly or showboating. It's a valid tactic to get you throwing from uncomfortable positions, off balance, and things like that. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that's me going off on a tangent, getting angry at people saying that. But yeah, it is exactly that. It's so unorthodox, and the distance he can close, the speed with which his reaction time, as said, that cyborg knee that was brutal, was just, it seemed so casual.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
electric.
And the other thing I love about him as well, and obviously, you know, I'll be even more impressed when I see these performances against higher level competition.
Completely. And a few years back, we would be saying, and I mentioned this to Rory, I would be saying he needs to be tested in the UFC. But Bellator have invested in that division, so I think he can be tested in Bellator. I still want to see him in the UFC in the end, but I don't think it's any more a case of you can't tell until you get to the big show. I think they've got Lima, they've got Daly, they've got Rory, they've got Koscheck, they've got a lot of people there that can.
There are lots of good matchups for him. I hope that he's given the right opportunities at the right time.
Yeah, and I agree.
I'd like to see more of him. I'd like to hear more of him. I'd like to see him pushed in the mainstream media a bit more.
He's just started a podcast as well.
Has he really?
Yeah, I'm sure I saw that today. But,
right.
But yeah, if he has, I'll mention it in the outro and give details. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, he is that special combination. And he is very marketable, and he's very, very intelligent as well. You know what I mean? He knows how to play the game.
It's what got me, and it made me think of it because of the Gangnam Style thing, but it's the perfect combination. That Pokemon celebration at the height of Pokemon Go, it would have been all right if he'd got an average win. But when you finish with what got voted the knockout of the year on most MMA sites, and you've got a current celebration that's just... It's a killer combination. Yeah.
No, he hit it out of the ballpark with that one.
Yeah.
And the other thing that he has, which I love, is he has that Mark Hunt confidence in his power.
Yeah.
That when he lands a shot and he knows it's over, he can enjoy it right in that moment. Yeah. You know, there are very few people that can do that. Nassim was another one.
Yeah.
You know, he knew once he touched somebody with that punch and they were on the way, now he can put the show on.
Yeah.
You know,
it's that Cantona posing just before it crosses at the line, and there's nothing like it.
I mean, I can't remember who it was. I want to say Marcin, his name was. I can't remember his last name. The kid that he did the 360 spinning kick.
Right, knocked him out.
Now, to know that you've landed a shot, you know, hard enough to knock the guy out, and be able to stand and pose and stare out of the cage as he staggers off and falls.
Or with your back to him, essentially, side on at least, kind of thing. It's
the one-up to the Mark Hunt walk-off. And that's a very special thing. I never had the calmness of mind to do that.
No.
The best I could do was to pick my next punch.
That was the only thing.
And that was something, I actually mentioned this in the book, that was something Ricardo Laborio told me one time. He was like, when you see a guy go down, don't rush in and throw loads of shots and go wild. Yep. Pause, take a minute, and pick the one punch that you want to land.
Now,
I mean, like when I fought Rory Markham, I remember doing exactly that in that moment. But that would have been one of those punches I could have easily done a walk-off knockout.
Yeah,
I just couldn't help myself, though, you know what I mean? It's
Well, that has to be on the bucket list for your return. Now, the only reason Dan Hardy wants to come back is to get that walk-off knockout. Because he's never had the calmness. But now he's in touch with his reptile self. He's going to be able to get that walk-off.
That's it.
Thank you very much for giving me...
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So it's a pleasure as ever to chat. And I can't wait to get my teeth into the book properly. And we'll talk again soon.
Definitely. Always good to talk to you, mate. Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
Man, how good was that? I mean, the last time we sat down and chat, it turned into two episodes and we spoke for over 3 hours, I think. I cut it short this time, but we could have kept going on and on and on. But he's a wonderful dude and the book is looking fascinating. So I'm hugely excited about that. Another thing I'm hugely excited about is UFC London at the weekend. But another thing I'm hugely excited about is Friday's episode with Rory McDonald. It's the first time he's been on. I'm very excited about it. Check that out. That's episode 142. Download and subscribe and all that kind of thing. If you do subscribe and set it to auto-download, then you don't have to worry. It'll just turn up. So check that out. And I will leave you there and see you on Friday. Ta-ta.